Well, this is our last session, and even though it's the last session, it's not too late to pray, so let's ask God to be with us and help us to use the time left on our retreat to our best advantage. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. The general heading for things that I want to talk about during this session would be helping others. There's that wonderful old story about the woman who was just shaking and could hardly get her breath, and being so elderly, she had a hard time walking. But finally, the Boy Scout got her to the other side of the street, and he was so proud of herself. And finally, when she caught her breath, the little boy was waiting for her to thank him, and she didn't say anything. And he says, "Aren't you going to thank me for helping you across the street?" She says, "That's what I've been trying to tell you. I didn't want to go across the street." A lot of us help people who don't want to be helped, and a lot of us have been helped to death by people who didn't know how to help sometimes. First of all, let's review. We started out the first night talking about faith, that beautiful story about the wheelbarrow, when all else remember to get back in the wheelbarrow. Trust whatever it is, whoever it is that you believe in. And even if your belief is small, trust. Trust that much. And the feedback will be obvious to you. I travel in circles with counselors, and when counselors get together, they do counselor talk. And there are two topics that counselors come up with a lot by way of complaints. So many of the people I work with are, and they say it different ways, but what it comes out to, so many of the people I work with or that I deal with are on hold. They're just waiting for something to happen or somebody else to change, and then they're going to be okay. Or then they're going to participate in life. So that's a good one to remember, being on hold. Another complaint they make, which I hear more and more often now, I didn't used to hear it so much, is that so many people are trying to figure out all of their problems before they start applying any of the solution. It's like we're going to survey the situation, be able to analyze it accurately, type up a plan, and by the time you get that all done, you're probably going to be dead or drunk. So you can start participating in the solution right away. And isn't it interesting that program people in their wisdom involve newcomers from the very beginning? Who would ever think that emptying ashtrays or setting up chairs is so important? But it really is. And even the new guy has a way to contribute and to participate and to be part of. Don't forget the Alexander Manville School of Counseling either. Because in his wisdom, when he tells people to shape up, if we really want to be honest about it, in so many areas of our life, many of us really know how to shape up. We just would rather talk about it or discuss it or share a lot of words connected with it so that we can hook other people into our self-pity. His other advice to people was, do something so you're not so boring. If that's your complaint, that life is boring, do something to not be so boring yourself, and then you'll start attracting people who are exciting. And there are all kinds of exciting people around. They're everywhere. Talk about the elephant joining the circus. I think we'd all really like to join the circus. One of the best times my home group ever had is when we went to the circus as a group. First activity we did as a group, we went to fireworks on the 4th of July, and we made so much noise and made such fools out of ourselves at the ASU Stadium people in the next four or five rows in front of us were turning around, sitting backwards, watching us instead of the performers. And we didn't know that we were going to be that silly, and we didn't know we were going to be that funny, and we didn't know we were going to have that much fun. Have you ever noticed how alcoholics don't participate in anything they can't control ahead of time? That's why they're lousy at sports. They can't get the fix in. I have a wonderful priest friend in Detroit, Vaughn Quinn, who runs a treatment center back there. And at one time, when I first met him, all of his guests, all of the people that were involved in treatment, were Skid Row types. And he does some real crazy things. But one of the most bizarre that I ever saw him do was to get those guys right out of detox playing volleyball. And, you know, if you've seen a bunch of guys from Skid Row, you know, if they get it over the net three times in a row, it's a big deal. But what happened before very long, even though they were awkward, they kept trying to have fist fights about the rules and all that kind of stuff. You know, after a little while, they forgot about themselves and they got interested in the game. And for some of them, it was the first time they forgot about themselves in years. And when you're on Skid Row and you're on the bum and you're not doing much of anything, you don't think you're thinking about yourself, but that's all you're thinking about. And a lot of us, when we're so preoccupied with self, do it in the name of other people. Or do it in the name of problems. That's why some of us like to have problems, because it keeps the focus on us. So the wheelbarrow story, where if all else fails, get back in the wheelbarrow. The idea of living in the present is real important too. Wherever you are, be there. And to whatever degree we can practice that, things will be much more meaningful for us. Because the present, right now, is the only time that change can take place. And there are a whole lot of attitudes that will help us in life, and one of those is to be questioning. Bring back the curious little child in us, and be able to explore this beautiful world, to realize that we don't know it all, and we really wouldn't want to. But to know more and to explore is really a grand adventure. You know, when you meet experts in a field, whether it happens to be a hobby or a vocation or whatever area of interest, the real top people in most of those fields know so much about the field, whatever it is, that they know how much they don't know. They're usually pretty humble people. And that's exciting, because they've got that much more to learn, and they realize the complexity of things. And certainly recovery falls into that category. You know, we're just on the beginning edge in history of people recovering from chemical dependency and from the dysfunction that happens in families. If I could rename alcoholism, I'd call it denial, because denial is ever-present and so persistent. And the denial is participated in and learned by the family members as well. Certainly the turning point in anybody's program, the real touchstone of their sincerity, has to do with inventory and being searching and fearless about that. This morning we talked about life being difficult, nothing working out the way we think it would, about disappointment, about guilt feelings, about shame. So now let's think and talk about how to help other people. Much of the time when we help other people, we don't know we're helping other people. And that's great if you're involved in an anonymous program. You know, I told you the story about George and I discovering the uglies and the ugly people. And that thing just builds and goes on and on and on. So much so that for a while I had some baseball caps made up that had an arrow pointing up on it and had up. And everybody saw that that was just kind of a silly little joke, but it really meant ugly person. And for a while on retreats I was choosing the head ugly in the group and giving him a baseball cap, and it got out of hand after a while, because he used to fight over the caps. So, I'm uglier than you are. There's another version of that told by a man named Bobby Earle, same kind of a story, and I like to share that too, and he doesn't mind me sharing his story. So it's about two guys sitting in a bar, and they're having a good time, and until one of them sneezed, and then the other fellow said, "God bless you," and the first guy starts choking and waving his arms, and he sneezes again, and the first guy says, "God bless you," again, and then he really gets excited. He said, "Would you please shut up? I didn't come in here to talk about God." And he said, "Well, okay, if that's your attitude, I won't say anything about God." He said, "You just did. You did it. That's three times now. I'm an atheist. I don't believe in God. I gave your God a good chance once. When I was younger, I was a prospector up in Alaska, and my partner and I were way out there in the backcountry, and this snowstorm came up, and we're on this narrow little trail, and I know that we're in trouble because there's some real sheer cliffs around there, and it's getting hard to see, so I decided to turn around and tell my partner that I think we ought to turn back. And I turn around, and he's not there. And I yell, and I scream, and I can't find him, and by this time there's a real blizzard going, and it's white out, and I can't see what's going on, and it's just terrible. So I had presence of mind enough just to stay in one spot, because if I wandered off, I might walk right off one of those cliffs. And I didn't know what to do. So I got down on my knees and prayed, because I heard about other people being in situations like this and praying. And I said, "God, if there is a God, get me out of here. Save my life, and I'll believe in you, and I'll tell other people about you." The other guy looks at him dumbfounded, and he says, Surely you believe. He says, "Believe in who?" He says, "Believe in God." He says, "Why?" He says, "Because you're alive. You're here today." He says, "Oh, yeah, but some goddamn Eskimo hadn't come along and froze to death out there." So, Bobby likes to talk about the Eskimos in his life, the little unexpected people that kind of pass through his life, you know, in my language, the uglies, the people that help us that don't even know that they're doing that. And that's wonderful, because nobody can live your life for you. But if you live it, you become an attractive person. There isn't anybody who really lives their life that doesn't have something to offer the rest of us. It's those of us who lead secondhand lives or try to lead a life that isn't ours, but that follow some kind of a script or a job description that was given to us by a parent or someone else or society. That's when we get to be real phony. And anybody can spot a phony. We know what they're like. And we really don't want to be phonies. There's an interesting sidelight there. When I first started working professionally in the field of alcoholism, there were some of these industrial programs or employee assistance programs, and there are a lot more of those now than there used to be. And there are a lot of people making a lot of money helping intervene with alcoholics and get them to treatment and educating their families. But when I was first around, there wasn't a whole lot of that. I've been to some conferences and some conventions where they have a lot of these employee assistance people gather together, and it's wonderful because almost all of them are recovering alcoholics. And it's amazing how much of the con artist is still there. In a sense, I don't want to poke fun at that, but I want to reflect back on your experience and mine in a practical kind of a way. Some of them go to great lengths to get help for these guys. And it's amazing some of the tricks that they pull and the ways that they are able to help people. Really, what a lot of these guys are, they have the title employee assistance counselor. They're really the resident sober con artist of the company. And, you know, there was an awful lot of conning and cunning and energy went into getting that next drink or protecting the supply or making up the excuses or convincing other people that our behavior was really okay or that it was someone else's fault. Now, you can clean all that up, and you can use that same energy and enthusiasm for helping somebody else. Remember the story I told you yesterday about the guy who thought he went to great heroic lengths to stay sober because he made a couple of phone calls? Well, a lot of us help others that way. You know, I talked to the guy for 10 minutes, gave him my phone number, but he didn't call back. You can put a little more effort into it than that. And we all can. The way a lot of people get those jobs, there's one company that I'm sure would not appreciate my talking this way. But if you go to work for this particular company, you do some written testing, and you have an oral interview, but you also have to talk to George, and George is their recovering alcoholic. He has a big fancy title. And if George says, even if you do well on those other tests, if George says, you know, there's something phony here, I don't think we ought to hire this guy, they pay a lot of attention to George. And even if you score poorly on those other tests, if George says, you know, I think you'll fit in here, they pay a lot of attention to George. George just seems to know who's going to work with that organization and who isn't. And what it comes down to is that George is really highly skilled at spotting phonies. That's a gift. It's embarrassing to find out how he got that way. Same way you and I got that way, huh? Because alcoholism makes us phony. It gets us crossways with ourselves and with our own values. And, you know, alcoholics don't need other people to upset them. We do that all by ourselves. Much of the material I used yesterday about denial comes from a book by Vern Johnson called I'll Quit Tomorrow. And in one of the appendix in the back of that book, he has a wonderful little story about an alcoholic who's just desperate and declares, you know, Doc, I'm just a civil war. That's a good description. I heard it another way once that had real meaning to me. This guy said, I'm so screwed up, I argue with myself till I lose. Yeah. And that's what we do, huh? And think about the things we talked about in terms of shame. You know, we're going to find a way to defeat ourselves. We're going to find a way to beat ourselves up. Now, I get real sensitive about telling other people how I think they ought to believe in God. But my personal experience, and my personal experience around program people, is that we perceive this higher power as friendly, as helpful, as encouraging, supportive, affirming. Now, it would be nice if we acted a little more on that belief by kind of going along with that agenda. So what I'm saying are a couple of things in terms of helping others. One of the best ways to help others is to feel better and be able to do good things for yourself, to have a better self-image, to diminish the shame in whatever way that you can. And the other way is to be eager and enthusiastic about it. I remember at the International AA Conference in New Orleans, there was a special session on sponsorship. And it was all conducted by old-timers. And it was wonderful to hear some of the things that they talked about. And one of the panel members said, there's only one point I want to make, and I hope you remember it. And as soon as he made the point, all of the others agreed with him. And the point was simply this. He said, whenever you have the opportunity to work with a newcomer that's asking for help or that qualifies for our program, let him know from the very beginning that he can make it and that you really believe that. Communicate that message. And I've tried to practice that ever since then, and it makes so much of the 12-step work and so much of the message carrying easier. Because given my natural tendency, I'm going to kind of keep score and say, this guy reminds me of the last jerk I worked with from Oklahoma, and you know what happened to him. You know, he's still drinking. And that's doing a terrible disservice. You know, because the message is real positive and real powerful. And if we let our own bad feelings about ourselves dilute or diminish or destroy the message, it can do us a lot of harm. Another thing about carrying the message, some of us who are perfectionists would like to practice 12-step calls so long before we actually go on one that nobody ever gets any help, you know. You pray and you do the best you can and you kind of psych it out later, not to to replay the thing, but just to find out if there's something you might do different the next time. But you get involved. And what you do is you share. You share your experience, strength, and hope. And isn't it wonderful that you and I, by sharing the very thing that people in our world today least want to share, we credential ourselves to the newcomer. Because it's in sharing our craziness and our insanity and the alcoholic thinking that we win the confidence of someone who's hurting. I had a great experience in April. I happened to be up in Denver, and I went to a meeting at the York Street Club. And I was sitting there having a hamburger at lunch, and there were about four of us sitting around this table, and a fellow came in with a newcomer. And he said, "I don't have time to talk to this fellow, but he thinks he might have a drinking problem, and why don't you guys talk to him?" We said, "Sure." So three of us started to work on him, and we're going, ta-da-ta-da-ta-da-ta-da-ta-da. And we're telling him all this happy stuff. And one of the guys isn't participating. He's just reading his newspaper. And his name was George, too, come to think of it. But when we got all done, there was a way that George folded up his newspaper that let the rest of us know that we were to be quiet and it was his turn. And he did that, and he looked the newcomer right in the eye, and he said, "I'm done with my paper now, and I've heard some of what's gone on here. Do you think you're an alcoholic?" The guy says, "Yeah, I think from what I've heard, I really am an alcoholic." So then the old-timer looked right in the eye and says, "Well, I don't have to know a lot more about you then. I know that you're a thief and a cheat and a liar." I never tried that approach. You know, because I'm doing all this sweet stuff about God and spirituality and how much fun we're going to have hanging around after meetings drinking coffee. And what blew my mind, this brand new guy, he's about 35 years old, who's shaken, said, "How'd you know?" And I came back the next 2 days for lunch, and that guy showed up both days. So he had two full days of sobriety by the time I left Denver, and it was wonderful. But here's somebody with a completely different approach than I'd ever seen before. You know, the guy's just brand new, stumbling in off the street, and we're calling him names. Now, I don't think I can get away with George's approach, but I'm glad I know someone who can. And the more people that we do know who work with newcomers, the more our approach is going to broaden out, and the richer we are, the more we have to offer. Let me jump ahead a little bit. We'll come back a couple of times more to helping others. I want to say something about relationships. Relationships are looked at by so many people as conveniences along the way to wherever it is we want to get. And I like to look at them more as the final exam, because that's where we really test out who we are and what we're about and where it is that we need to grow. And there are a lot of people who are great working with newcomers and being very well thought of in their home group that aren't even speaking to their family members or the people closest to us. And it's the people closest to us that we always seem to have the most trouble with. You know, if they just shape up, which really means if they just do it my way. So relationships can be a great opportunity. I don't think I've shared this particular thing with people on these kinds of retreats before, but I do a lot of retreats not directed particularly to program people, but to married couples. And I wrote something about marriage a few years ago. So whether you're married or not, you can listen to this. It says a lot about relationships and a lot about God. And it's titled this: "Marriage is many things, but most of all, it's a mystery." Now, if you're into answers, that's a big threat. If you're into questions, it's wonderful. Have you ever wondered about Adam and Eve? Most of us have. What were they doing under that tree? We wonder about marriage, too. What's it all about? How can we make it better? Is there any hope? Just to write about marriage is frightening. I'm not adequately prepared. Neither is anyone adequately prepared for marriage. Marriage is so many different things. But most of all, marriage is a mystery. I love a mystery. So do you. It's in our blood. Without exaggeration, our lives can be described as wrestling with a series of mysteries. They cry out to be dealt with. Yes, marriage is a mystery, and I love it. Let me show you what I mean. See, some of you taking notes. You don't have to bother. I'll give you this later. I got this. Remember the old radio program, I Love a Mystery? Okay, that's where that came from. I just hear that thing, I love a mystery, and I go nuts. It's wonderful. I love a mystery. Why in the whole world, with all the many people to choose from, did the bride and groom choose each other? That's a mystery. I love a mystery. You may think I'm crazy, but they didn't choose each other. They just think they did. They were chosen by someone higher. The mystery deepens. I love a mystery. Talk about mystery. Marriage is the union of two people, yet with God it is not two, but three. Even before the young couple begins, there is a triangle. Marriage has all the elements of sacrament and soap opera. I love a mystery. We are called to marriage. It's that simple. Never mind about being adequately prepared. Never mind about it making sense. Never mind. God knows what he's doing. I love a mystery. What about the marriages that fail? Have the people failed? No. They just have more to learn about marriage. But we all do. I love a mystery. How can two silly kids mature so rapidly in this situation? The answer is obvious when you realize who called them. I love a mystery. Why do some not grow in marriage? I don't know, but I do know this. We all have more to learn. I love a mystery. This is not to say that we should not prepare for marriage or try to make it better. Yet without God as the central lover, something essential is missing. With God, oh, there's a typing mistake here too. It says with God, it should be without God. It should read this way. Without God, marriage becomes a dress rehearsal. I love a mystery. Some marriages are destroyed by triangles. All are kept together by one. Bride, groom, God. I love a mystery. These thoughts are for the married and for those of us not married. But so is marriage. It's for all of us. I love a mystery. Marriage begins with two simple words, I do, but there are not enough words in all the dictionaries of the world to describe the effect of that commitment. I love a mystery. In a world full of casual infidelity, God continually calls us to be faithful. I love a mystery. Marriage is about total, unreserved commitment by two weak, vulnerable human beings. And yet the commitment grows if they work on it. I love a mystery. The longer people are married, the more they realize their dependence on God. The deeper they love each other, the more they love others. Now you have to remember who wrote this next one. I love a mystery. Personally, I don't want a wife. I want several. But God's ways are not our ways. He did not call me to marriage. He called me to something else. Like many who are not married, we stand in awe of those who accept this call. I love a mystery. Marriage is a great joy. Marriage is hard work. It's about sickness. It's about health. It's about good times and bad. It demands total attention and giving. I love a mystery. Marriages begin each morning and they die each night. Each married day is a brand new day. I love a mystery. To study marriage is to stand before the mysteries of life. It is both close to home and a holy place. I love a mystery. So does God. He invented marriage. A lot of ideas about relationships. Relationships are never simple because they're alive and they're growing. Let me say a word at this point in favor of pain. Pain's been given a bad name. But everyone that I know has gotten here because of pain. Nobody joined Alcoholics Anonymous or Al-Anon just because they thought it was the in thing to do. Or they read something in Ladies' Home Companion and wanted to keep up with the neighbors. You come to these programs because you're hurt. And I'm living testimony of that. I've been sober almost 18 years. When I first came to Al-Anon, I was sober 7 or 8 years. I don't really remember which. That says a lot about my codependency. I was so screwed up when I came to Al-Anon, I don't know what year it was. But when I went to my first, and before that, I'd been sending a lot of people to Al-Anon who really needed it. And when I went to my first Al-Anon meeting, I had this huge lump in my throat, and I shook, and I couldn't talk. See, my head told me Al-Anon was a good thing, and it was wonderful, and I didn't have to be afraid of it. But that shows you how much my head has to say with what I'm doing. All my head does is keep score about the other things that make decisions, like my habits and impulses and character defects and feelings. Anyway, if you're having trouble with a relationship, terrific. Thank God for it. You got something to work on. And I know what you're thinking. Yeah, but you don't know my relationship. That feeds right into that terminal uniqueness stuff that's part of our sickness. That's our disease talking to us. I'm different. No one will understand me. And as long as you have that attitude, who wants to? Anyway, sobriety is a wonderful thing, and it has a lot to do with being comfortable. Being comfortable in uncomfortable situations. I talked about my mom a little while ago. You know, if she were alive today and knew about some of the people I hung around with and some of the places I go and some of the places I feel comfortable. You know. For a long time, the Arid Club in downtown Phoenix was, my 5:30 meeting was my home group. And that's enough to scare a middle-class, normal person into panic, particularly when the people start showing up for the meeting. But my experience has been that if I'm really in trouble, I can always count on going down there and hearing what I need to hear. It kind of half facetiously, but it's a lot truer than I meant it when I first jokingly described my home group that way. I talk about that place as being where all the wrong people show up and say all the right things. And that's because really there aren't any wrong people. God can use anybody. And he continues to do that. All we have to do is wake up and realize that. Now, for those of you who are just listening to this, you have to use your imagination a little bit because I'm going to draw on the board here. And something I always work into these retreats, just because I found it so helpful and people tell me it is the idea that life is made up of ups and downs, high points and low points. So I'm drawing on the board something that looks like high points and low points, large waves. Sometimes we get real high, and sometimes we try to maintain that, but it doesn't work. We always come down, and usually the higher we've been, the further down we come, and some of us have been real down, and that gets to be a habit. Then we find out that for some reason we're kind of happy, and we get all upset. You know, we don't even know what we want. Some of you in here know an Indian friend of mine named Bill. And Bill and I have a little in-joke, kind of something that started out between us that other people don't understand. Bill lived in abject poverty for a long time on a reservation that didn't have much. Then they discovered some very valuable minerals on that reservation. And all of a sudden he was rich. And there were some things he wanted to do. And he finally got to do them. And what Bill wanted to do was be a playboy. And he had the looks, but he never had the money to take anybody out. So now he could do that. And he kind of got burned out on that after a while. And he crashed and burned with alcoholism, and he wound up here. And he has a great deal of faith. And when we see each other, I have the first line. And my line is, "Hi, Bill, how you doing?" And his line is, "Ah, nothing's going my way." And that means everything's fine. Okay? My higher power is in charge, because I don't know what's good for me. And it's funny to be in a situation where people overhear that, because they rush in and try to fix them. "Oh, what's the matter?" He says, "Oh, no, things are just fine the way they are. Don't worry about it. Nothing's going my way." What a beautiful statement that is, of surrendering our own ideas of what's best for us. Anyway, sometimes we've been higher than some people and lower, and what's symptomatic of most alcoholics, we've been that more often. That's when your life just kind of gets out of control and you're trying to catch up with your brain to shut it off so that you can figure out what's going on. And at times like that, we pray, "Dear God, please let me be normal." And we define normal like this. I'm just drawing a straight line on the board. And all you have to do is think about that a little bit, and you realize that none of us want to be normal that way, because that's not normal, that's death. That's boring, catatonic, and none of us want that. So to realize that life is made up of ups and downs is to have some maturity and be able to accept that. However, I look at these as the high points. And these is the low points. And for those of you who are just listening, I'm labeling the higher points on the board as the low points, and I'm labeling the lower points on the board the high points. I hope you're sober enough to understand that. Why would I turn it around that way? Anybody have any idea? Why? When you think you're high, you're in a dangerous position. That's part of it, yeah. What else?
The low, that high point down there at the bottom, that's when you just get back in and doing something.
That's right. This, what I've called a high point down here at the bottom, is when you're ready, you're willing.
To do something.
That's right. You can get in motion. Very often when I'm up here at one of these low points, I have the attitude, "I don't need you, I don't need God, I don't need anybody." And real soon, I'm going to be miserable and lonely when I have the attitude, "I don't need you, I don't need God, I don't need anybody. So the point I'm making here is that there are a lot of people who, for a lot of different reasons, make a decision not to participate in life below the line. And look at their life, these bumpy little things that are kind of disconnected, that don't make a whole lot of sense. And people who live their life that way spend a lot of time wondering why they're missing out on things. Remember what I said yesterday about the kind of person that you go to when you're looking for advice and seeking someone with a lot of wisdom? They're always the people who have lived down here below the line, and while they were there, they lived fully. Now, I don't wish any more of this on you, below the line. And I don't want to take anything away from you above the line, but I'm asking you, what are you doing with this down here? Are you just complaining and feeling sorry for yourself? Or are you trying to learn something and get into action? Back again to Scott Peck's wonderful definition of discipline. The ability to deal with the pain of a situation first and the pleasure later. It's when we don't feel good and when we don't feel like it, that once we learn to get into action, and sometimes it's expressed acting as if, you know, we go through the motions, that a lot of growth and a lot of meaning and a lot of understanding comes. You and I live in a wonderful age when all kinds of people everywhere are getting sober and have a chance to do that. So it's an exciting time. Anytime you don't find your life exciting, it's because you're into self. It's that simple. All you have to do is bring some other people in your life or try to share this, carry this message, and the excitement starts happening, which will get you in touch with anger again, because they don't do the excitement right either. They're never on schedule. But life is something that we participate in, and very often it happens to us. And when it happens to us, it doesn't happen in our time or according to our plan. Again, God is sneaky. He has ways of teaching us and getting our attention go far beyond what it is that you and I could design for ourselves for some kind of self-improvement course. Let me get back to that idea of our character defects being assets. Who ever thought of that? When you're talking to a newcomer, yeah, don't be too quick to badmouth character defects. You know, in step 6, we take those character defects we became aware of through inventory, and we become willing to have God remove them. In step 7, we ask Him to remove them. But just because we become willing, in all of them too, but we become willing to have them all removed, and we ask Him to remove all of them, just because we do that, which is exactly what we're taught to do, doesn't mean that God does it. I mean, the evidence is overwhelming. God does not remove all character defects. I mean, just look around. See? If He did, you'd be perfect. Yeah, right. And either you're perfect or you're not. And if you're perfect, we would have noticed by now. Bright group like this. The whole deal is, you still got a bunch of character defects, but it's not up to you to choose which ones you get to keep. And God kind of sorts that out. And if you've been around a while at all, you know, because of your personal experience, that God uses your character defects. Because there's somebody else that's got the same set of crummy ones, but He doesn't know that there's someone else walking around loose that has them. And when He meets you, He realizes there are two of you. And then He's not so alone. And if you're working a program, you've probably, in addition to those character defects that He's been so embarrassed about, you've got something that is attractive that He wants that'll help Him grow too, in spite of the character defects. So, I'm making a case for two things we usually don't talk favorably for, and that's pain, which can really be our friend. I don't wish you any additional pain, but what are you doing with the pain that's in your life? Because it's always an opportunity. And are you thanking God for the character defects that you have? Because you should. Because after all, it's His business which ones you have, if you've been working program. You see, when that newcomer asks for help, you sit down and you share your character defects with them. You tell them your story. You share your experience, strength, and hope. Look at how outrageous that is, that method, how revolutionary it is. It hadn't happened till AA come along. Compare it to a professional setting where you go to, let's suppose you go to John's psychiatrist, $90 an hour, and you're going to have your first session, and you're just about ready to describe your big problem, and the psychiatrist says, "Now, before we get started here, let me tell you how screwed up I am." And then he tells you about all the skeletons in his closet, and the fact that he is afraid to cross the street by himself, or whatever it is. You know, about 5 minutes into that drill, you're going to try to figure out how to get your money back, right? Because this guy's totally incompetent. And yet, when you try the same thing, it works backwards. It's paradoxical again. It does for you what you couldn't do for yourself, and it does for that other person what the professionals couldn't do. It makes you a credible person who knows something about what he's talking about. Yeah, there aren't many people in this room, based on your history, that should be walking around loose functioning in society. I mean, I think they would lock up the wrong people. But if I were to look for a group for some real spiritual help, or if I really needed some common sense wisdom or some feedback about a personal problem, I'd come to you guys. Because you haven't failed me yet. You really haven't failed me. A little earlier I talked about AA or program wisdom. You know, sometimes at a meeting where something awkward happens or somebody kind of acts out of line, I always used to feel super responsible. And I used to practice my speech. As soon as this meeting's over with, I'm going to tell that person, da-da-da-da-da-da. And the nice thing that's happened so many times with me, somebody else beats me to it. And usually while the meeting's still going. And they'll very gently get a message through to the person. And in a non-threatening and yet very forceful way, the group will kind of agree with the person. And then the person who's out of line will suddenly see some group conscience in action. And they won't have to be the jerk that they were before. Let me share an example of that. I was at a meeting one night in Casa Grande. That was bizarre because, well, without, you know, things don't have to make sense to have value. At one time, a bunch of young people in Tucson wanted to have a young people's meeting. They didn't know how to run one. And at that, those days, I went to the young people's meeting here in Phoenix. So we promised we'd go to Tucson to put a young people's meeting on for them. Well, there's no difference between a young people's meeting and any other kind of meeting, but somehow the Tucson people thought there was. And then someone got the idea of meeting halfway, you know, in Casa Grande. So we finally found a friendly Presbyterian pastor down there who lent us a classroom. And we met once a month for years in Casa Grande, you know, two or three cars from Phoenix, two or three from Tucson. And it was wonderful. Nobody from Casa Grande knew about the meeting, but, you know. And it was fun because you never know until the last minute who you're going to ride with. And then we went for coffee afterwards, and then we swapped people off in different cars. You spent the whole evening. It was a grand adventure. Anyway, one night at that meeting, some guy said, I'd sure like to be sober, but this program doesn't work for me. Well, that got everybody's attention real quick. And he said, the reason for that is, besides being an alcoholic, I have this other problem, and the other problem gets in the way of me getting any real help with alcoholism. And I'm really jealous of you people who can work this program and stay sober. You see, I'm schizophrenic. And his definition of schizophrenic was very obviously multiple personalities. Huh? And he said, I got papers to prove it, too. And it's terrible, because there's just more than one of me, and one of me comes to the meeting and tries to work the program, and the other one goes out and starts drinking again. Well, there was, you know, that, yeah, right, that, you know, that crummy thinking, that stinking thinking just sat in the middle of that room for a while, and nobody touched it. And I'm going nuts because I figure, you know, they're going to fail me and I'll have to try to fix it. Well, I didn't, again, because some elderly woman spoke up and she was talking about whatever's on her mind. She said, oh, by the way, honey, I got the answer to your problem. And he looked up and he says, yeah, you don't have to drink anymore. He says, I don't? How come? She says, all you have to remember is if any one of you take a drink, you all get drunk. yeah. And the guy understood. The guy understood that. Yeah. Now where else are you going to get that kind of wisdom? Yeah. Where else? You know, and it's available to us anytime we ask for it. Anytime we ask for it. God really is sneaky. He knows what's best for us, and He knows how to surprise us with the information and the opportunities that we need. But there's more than that, too. You can bring this enthusiasm that I talked about yesterday in terms of inventory and spoke of earlier today in terms of helping others to living the program for yourself. And you can invite God into your life in new ways and not just wait for Him to surprise you. You can make room for the miracles. You can look for the serendipitous events. Yeah, I love that word, serendipity. It's an unexpected little blessing, serendipitous. And life is full of those things. And the more we become attuned to those and the more we become aware of it, the more we become alive and relaxed, what a bonus. We don't have to struggle as hard because we're not trying to play God. All retreats have to come to an end, and we're at that point with this one. For those of you that are listening, this is being taped in August of 86 at the Franciscan Renewal Center in Scottsdale. If you should have the address on the tape or on the box, but just in case you don't, write Stepping Into Freedom, Post Office Box 220, Scottsdale, Arizona, 85252. There is a God. He exists. He's good to us. He's blessed us. And we can appreciate that blessing by sharing it with each other. And that's my prayer for each of us, that we not hoard or try to figure out what we have been given, but share it freely with others and sit back and watch the blessings be showered on others and on our lives. Would you like to lead us in the Lord's Prayer?
Father.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever. Amen.
He's coming back, good works.